escada é uma construção que serve para fazer um deslocamento vertical. Nem sempre é assim, mas tem um jeito de facilitar tudo isso. De elevador? Não.
Seja bem-vindo e seja bem-vinda a uma edição super especial do Chutando a Escada com o professor Marcos Wagner e com o Ian Link, que é o responsável por essa entrevista. O papo está em inglês e nele você aprenderá muito sobre a situação da política austríaca. Se você quiser ouvir um relato do próprio Ian Link sobre a situação da Áustria, basta entrar no nosso site, o www.chutandoaescada.com.br. Mais uma vez, eu gostaria de agradecer imensamente o Ian Link e o professor Marcos Wagner por enviar esse material de altíssima qualidade para a gente. Bom, sem mais delongas, vamos escutá-los.
Let's get started. First of all, Mr. Wagner, I'd like to ask you to introduce yourself. Why are you? What's your area of research here at the University of Vienna?
Okay, my name is Markus Wagner. I'm a professor in political science here at the University of Vienna, and I've worked on the Austrian national election study for about 7 years.
Austria is a small country. Why should the world care about the results of the elections here? Why are they important?
Well, I mean, obviously, Austria is a small country, and within Europe, it's a smallish country. But I think it's sort of a typical European country. So that's the parties that you have here are pretty typical of parties that you have in many European countries. So you have a center left party and a center right party, a green party, and then you have like a radical right party. So these are typical European parties, and so the kind of developments you see in Austria are kind of typical of developments in Europe generally. And there's two things that are particularly interesting about Austria right now. So one is the sort of the strength of the radical right party, so the sort of the nationalist, sort of slightly anti-immigrant party, the Freedom Party. And the other thing is that Austria played a big role in the refugee crisis in 2015. So it's really interesting, I think, to see how a country which is sort of highly developed and very wealthy reacts to this influx of immigrants and what kind of political effects that has.
I think I already mentioned quite a few topics that I was going to ask you about.
Okay, great.
We're going to get there.
Yeah, yeah.
First of all, why did we even have elections this year? I thought it was supposed to happen next year. What happened that things happened earlier than expected?
Yeah, normally the elections would have been next year, so there's five-year periods in Austria. And the reason was, I mean, basically the two government parties exchanged their leaders, and so they both thought that they were in a pretty good position in the election. So it was kind of a strategic choice that they thought, okay, if we have elections now, then maybe we'll actually have a good result before the leaders maybe take unpopular decisions or their newness wears off. And especially the center-right party, the Christian Democrats, they had a very popular new young leader, and they wanted to use that popularity. And so they kind of, I think, basically they decided to end the coalition because they thought they would do well in the election.
Would you say it was a mistake from the other party of the coalition, the Social Democrats, to not break the coalition themselves? So they would have, I don't know, they would set the agenda, or would that have made any difference at all?
Yeah, there would have been the opportunity for the Social Democrats, the other party in government, to maybe break the election, sort of break the government up a bit earlier. Maybe they missed an opportunity. You know, it's hard to tell, but they definitely really faced a tough situation with this new young leader on the center-right who was really popular. And I think that was something that really didn't play into their hands. So if they could have avoided that, that would have been good.
Well, this young leader we're talking about, his name is Sebastian Kurz, yeah, from the Austrian People's Party. His party reached 31.8% of the votes, so it was a clear victory. He's probably going to be the next prime minister of Austria, and should that happen, which is the most likely, I would say 99% of chance that happens, what would that mean for the future of the European Union and Austria's relationship with the European Union?
Yeah, so the interesting thing is that his party is traditionally the most pro-European, pro-EU party, but actually Sebastian Kurz is just 31. He sort of is less emotional about the EU. It's something that he takes a bit more for granted, and he's actually quite a lot more critical towards the EU, especially when it comes to questions of sort of freedom of movement within the EU and also taking in immigrants and asylum seekers. So it looks like sort of Austria will take a bit more EU critical stance in the next few years, maybe be a bit more of a difficult country within the EU, take up slightly more conflictual stances. So traditionally, Austria wasn't actually a very difficult country in the EU, it sort of took part in most initiatives, but maybe in the next few years it will be, there'll be more, they'll make themselves a bit more unpopular in the EU.
I think during the elections, Sebastian Kurz and the leader of the FPÖ, the Freedom Party, the far-right party, Strache, there was one debate that I watched a little bit, and they were kind of competing who was better friends with Viktor Orban from Hungary, which is a pretty controversial leader, so to speak. Could this mean that maybe Governor Sebastian Kurz would be a bit more, would follow the Orban line, a bit more authoritarian, or is it too early to tell?
Yeah, I don't think Sebastian Kurz is an authoritarian, and he's definitely not anti-democratic, or he's sort of not as tough as the sort of Hungarian or Polish governments. He's more a traditional leader in that way, but his stances on immigration and on asylum policy are definitely more in line with Orban's stance and with the sort of more Central European stance, and I think that's definitely a sort of what will shift to be an important shift in the EU. And I mean, I don't see Kurz as like a necessarily a dangerous politician, but it's sort of a real shift of emphasis and a shift in policy, especially on that question, and where they have a lot more sympathy with governments that really take a tough stance on the asylum question.
So would you say that that's pretty much everything that of course, not everything, but that would be pretty much almost everything that they have in common. Kurz and Orban would be the anti-immigrant stance, and other than that, there's not much more that connects them.
Yeah, I don't see a lot connecting Orban and Kurz. I mean, we'll have to see what Kurz is like in government, but I find Orban to be a much more sort of really populist politician who sort of uses popular fears and popular anxieties and resentments to shore up his power and to be a stronger politician. And we'll see how Kurz behaves, but he's, in my mind, he's not quite as populist, quite as tough, quite as willing to make enemies as Orban is.
Although lots of people said that his campaign, which was based pretty much on the immigrant topic and criticism of Islam, had some very stark populist tones. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think, well, I wouldn't necessarily call them populist. I would call them clearly sort of anti-immigrant, really a new line. So, I mean, for me, populism means that you sort of try to say that the people are always right and the elite is sort of corrupt and that sort of thing. And that's, he's not really that. So he hasn't criticized the elite so much. He's taken a stance which is really strongly critical of immigration and taking sort of really simplistic statements in a way about immigration. So saying there is, you know, we want no more illegal migrants. So very sort of simplifying, very sort of easy to sell. And that kind of sort of lack of nuance, that kind of toughness, that's something that's quite new from a mainstream party. I mean, most mainstream parties in Europe wouldn't phrase things in such a strong way. And that is really new.
How do you see this rise of the far right in Austria and in the European Union? I mean, Austria has lived with a strong FPÖ, the strong Freedom Party, for about 30 years. I mean, I don't know, but I think that was one of the first countries, one of the first European countries that witnessed such a rise in the far right. How did they manage to become so popular here? How did a far-right party become able to appeal to such a broad base of so many electors?
Yeah, I think there's two reasons why the radical right or the far right is so popular in Austria. So one more historical reason is that compared to Germany, for example, there was never so much such a taboo on radical right positions. So Austria didn't tackle the Nazi history so strongly. The political education in schools wasn't so so strict in a way, and also the media didn't have that taboo. So they sort of allowed or allowed the radical right to rise much more than in some other countries. But the other big thing that is very typical of Austria, very, very unique, is that the two big parties work together really closely, at least, you know, since the Second World War. There was always sort of a very compromise-oriented political system. So the radical right became sort of the key opposition party, the only big party outside of this coordinated cooperation between the two big parties. So anybody who was fed up with the two big parties who wanted change basically voted for the radical right. So they attracted all the protest voter, all the disaffected voters in the system. And that's different from other European countries where there's some kind of change in government regularly. But in Austria, because the two big parties always work together in some way or another, there was a lot of frustration with that, and that really helped the radical right to gain votes.
And why didn't the Greens become the protest vote? Why did the FPÖ receive those votes?
Well, so first of all, I think the main reason is the Greens' positions are just not as popular. So you have to think that in Austria, most people are skeptical of immigration, and they're not sort of urban, highly educated voters concerned about and the environment and sort of having very liberal social positions. So the Greens, they did get some of the protest vote, but only among a certain segment of the population. But they have views that are just really different from what most people in Austria want.
Yeah, I think the Greens are pretty much an urban, middle-class party.
Yeah, exactly. The core is sort of urban voters, people who are relatively well-educated and also have sort of not that badly off. So we're not really concerned about the material things so much.
Okay. So you say that Austria didn't really, about its Nazi past. It didn't really become a taboo like in Germany. Why is that? How did this happen?
I mean, that's going away back, but the key thing I think is that in Germany, the main parts of society really strongly agreed that this shouldn't happen again, that there shouldn't be another radical right party. So also the media played along, all the parties played along. They said, well, there's going to be no space for a party to the right of the political system. And in Austria, that taboo didn't exist because Austria didn't see itself necessarily as the country where the Nazis came to power, but they were sort of taken over and then sort of invaded almost in 1938. At least that was the way they saw it. So they didn't see themselves as responsible for the Second World War in the same sense that Germans did, and the elites just didn't take that responsibility. So there's different kinds of, because Germany was so strongly responsible and also thought that taking that responsibility would help it be more important internationally, they took that decision, whereas Austria didn't really see itself like that. So Austria is more like other European countries where the radical right managed to rise.
Yeah, because I guess they saw themselves as victims rather than responsible.
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of a view that Austria was the first victim of Nazism, which some people still believe, even though many Austrians were more than willing to cooperate with the Nazis.
Do you see any parallels between the Austrian Freedom Party and the German AfD?
Yeah, so they're very similar in their anti-immigration focus. They're also similar in the sense that they don't really like the EU, although the AfD, the German radical right party, is more Eurosceptic, at least publicly. So they meet a lot and they cooperate and they're happy about each other's success. So they're sort of clearly sister parties, and they're very similar philosophies behind them. Where they're different is that the FPÖ is much more established. The Freedom Party in Austria, it's been around for a long time, over 30 years in this form. And it's a real normal player in Austrian politics, and it has institutional power that the AfD doesn't have.
Do you see the potential for the AfD to grow just like the FPÖ has?
It depends. So if they don't have too many scandals, if they have sort of personnel that sort of is, manages to stick to a good, a clear ideological line and doesn't become known for incompetence and infighting, there's always going to be 10 to 15% of people who sort of share those positions. So I think it may well become a stable force. I don't think it will become as strong as the Freedom Party in Austria. That's very unusual. But in most European countries, you have a radical right party that's sort of between 5 and 15%. And I don't see why Germany should be an exception.
I guess in Germany, that would be my guess. I think there's also more historically, there's been more competition within the parties. There's always been more strong parties than in Austria. I mean, I would say that for a very long time, you can only choose between the Social Democrats and the Christian Democrats, and then eventually the far right came along. But for a very long time, this became ingrained in people's minds that there was only these two choices. And then, whereas in Germany, you've had the liberals, which have been very strong for a very long time, and I guess the Greens as well, and the Left Party. So maybe, I don't know if that makes any sense, but maybe there's just more concurrence, more competition between the parties.
Well, an interesting thing could diversity. Be, so interesting what could happen is if the CDU takes a slightly more tough position, and sort of the center right can maybe take some votes back from the AfD, and then the sort of the communists, the old sort of the Linke party in Germany, if it manages to attract the protest voters again, that can weaken the AfD in the long term. So it really depends on what the other parties do and if they manage to steal back the voters from the AfD, especially if the AfD doesn't do a good job and they're a new party and they have sort of inexperienced politicians. So who knows what will happen?
I think what you just mentioned there about gaining back the far-right votes, I think that's a strategy many established parties have tried, like in Germany, CDU, and even the Social Democrats, to sort of speak, steal some of the rhetoric and some of the topics, some of the themes from far-right parties, but there's some people who would say, well, it doesn't work because it only reinforces their discourse within society and it only makes those parties in the far right stronger. At the same time, we see that here Sebastian Kurz from the People's Party has done that and it kind of worked. So, I don't know, maybe there isn't a recipe where one size fits all, but I don't know, do you think that strategy even works? Like trying to imitate the far right in order to steal their voters?
I mean, I think it can work, and I think the Austrian example shows that it is possible to attract voters who would otherwise vote for the radical right by taking strong anti-establishment and anti-immigration, especially, positions. And there's lots of people who don't really like sort of the radicalism, the extremism of the radical right parties, but also want there to be less immigration, and so they're happy if there's a respectable option that also kind of represents their views. But the longer term question is what you gain by making these opinions, sort of by normalizing these opinions, by taking their stances, by taking the radical right stances and by sort of basically adopting their positions, then you're basically seeing those are the right positions, and in the long term that's quite dangerous, especially if those are positions that are then the parties have to then realize, and that really changes the way that the country will develop. And do you really want the radical right views to become the normal views of parties? And that's what sort of the dangerous development is. So, I mean, what have you gained if you manage to reduce the vote share of the radical right, if it means that you have to take up their positions? So it does work, but I don't know if it's sort of a reasonable solution to the question.
Maybe in the long run, people are just going to choose the original one.
Yeah, I mean, it can. So it's difficult.
Backfire.
Yeah, I mean, we don't really know don't know because it's only sort of been a question for the last 10 or 15 years. So we'll have to see like what happens in the long term, and it may backfire. Especially if you say that these positions are fine, then there's also no reason not to vote for the radical right party in the future.
Let's talk a bit more globally also, starting from Austria. In France and Germany, we saw that the social democracy has not done very well.
Yeah.
In Austria, they managed to remain keep all their seats. They haven't gained much, but they didn't gain much, but they didn't lose anything. Still, I think for a while now, people have been talking about a crisis of the social democracy across Europe. I don't know what's going on with social democracy in Europe.
Well, I think the difficult thing for the social democrats is that their core voter base, the working class, is shrinking. So there's fewer and fewer sort of manual workers, and those people, the manual workers, are now concerned about topics such as immigration and also globalization that the social democrats aren't really willing to address in the way that maybe that class wants. So the social democrats kind of take a more pro-immigration position. They also recognize that globalization sort of is needed to have economic growth generally. And that just sort of, those aren't positions that, for many working class people, those aren't very popular. So that's the one problem. And the other problem is that because the working class is shrinking, they need to find new voters. And those new voters are sort of maybe more urban, more educated, more sort of professional type voters that are maybe work public sector, teachers, nurses, doctors, and so on, who are sort of more liberal. And those people have different views and preferences than manual workers, and trying to attract both groups at the same time is really challenging. So the social democrats are sort of faced with this changing society in Europe, and to remain a big party, they have to make these big coalitions of different groups of voters, and that's really challenging.
And I think one of the criticisms that I've seen every now and then from a left perspective is that they need to find their left ideals again, because many see the social democracy as having sold their soul to neoliberalism. I think Germany would be a good example of this, because of these reforms that happened in the years around 2000, again to 2010, with the flexibilization of the work market. Yeah. That many say that hurt created a very large low wage sector that's hurt workers. Would you say that social democracy as a... Well, it's hard to generalize, because every country has a different story, but just say that as a whole, social democracy kind of shifted, if not to the right, maybe to the center.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely been a shift towards more centrist views. So the good example is in Austria, in the election last week, the social democrats only got 20% of the vote of manual workers, and the radical right got 60%. Yeah. So it's really the social democrats in Austria are really no longer the party of the working class. And the reason is, in one sense, is that they no longer speak to people who are angry about the economic situation. So I think if you go back 50 years, then the people who wanted to change the economic system and make it fairer and really sort of had quite radical ideas, sort of anger about inequality and all those things, they would vote for the social democrats. But nowadays, the social democrats, they're more establishment party. They attract people, and they have to attract people, like I said, who are actually in the cities and do quite well and so on, because they need more votes. So they no longer take those positions. So they don't stoke that anger. They don't benefit from that anger or from those sort of revolutionary positions anymore, because... if they did that, that would also be dangerous for them, because they might also lose other voters. So it's a really, so from a strategic point of view, they're in a difficult position. So they could take more left-wing positions, more sort of more radical positions on the economy, but it's unclear whether that would actually benefit them in the long run, especially with changing societies.
Well, I mean, on the other hand, we've seen Jeremy Corbyn in England has done quite well. He's turned his party back to his left wing roots. I don't know if we can say that, but somehow it worked. I mean, maybe there's a solution, maybe one path that social democracy could take.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So the positions that Corbyn takes, like the manifesto in the UK, is actually not that radical, right? So the nationalizing railways, I mean, in most European countries, the state has a big role in running the railways, and also other matters that the proposals he makes aren't actually that radical. So he's actually more reasonable than you think. But what he manages to do, and that kind of relates to what I just said, he inspires the people who are unhappy and angry, right? And for some reason, the many other social democratic parties don't manage to get those voters. They're unwilling to engage with them. They just don't have the rhetoric. They're too much part of the establishment. They're sort of too responsible in a way. And Jeremy Corbyn just seems a bit more responsible. And that's what some people, I think, want, or maybe people are actually, they want people who challenge the status quo.
Well, maybe England has been so liberalized and so privatized that actually makes them easier to defend things that already are a reality in other European countries.
Yeah, exactly. And that's also a problem that the Social Democrats don't have very much to fight for because they've achieved so much. So in most European countries, there's good pension systems, there's good protection for employees, there's good unemployment systems, good healthcare. You know, the basic things that the Social Democrats fought for are there. So obviously they need to be protected, but that's, you know, that's less exciting than actually managing to get these things in the first place.
Protecting things that are already there are not so, it's just not as sexy. You can't sell it to the public very well.
Yeah, exactly. So they're in a difficult position, the Social Democrats. But, you know, maybe in 15 years, everything will be different again. So politics is surprising.
You know, I mean, and well, that's just one thought I have sometimes, that because of migration, I think societies used to be more homogeneous.
Yeah.
So a social state was there for everyone.
Yeah.
And now there's so many migrants, I guess some workers think, well, the state is there for me, but the state is also given so much to this other guy who's only arrived for a couple of years ago, and his family hasn't been here for that long as I have. So why should he get as much as me? And I just wonder if there's a way to come out of this trap, because I think that like migration kind of divides society in this way. I don't know if there's a way to come out of that.
I mean, yeah, I don't know if it's definitely an important development. So there's a lot of resentment against migrant groups and immigrants, and so whereas in earlier decades, people would have been angry at other groups of people, maybe at sort of the rich people or the bosses, you know, that sort of economic groups. Now the resentment from many people is towards immigrants, and that obviously divides a country much more, and also kind of reroutes the anger to a different group of people. And I don't know how that can be solved in the long term. I mean, there are countries that take very different attitudes to immigration and are much more inclusive, and they don't have that strong resentment. So, I mean, maybe it's possible that European countries also move towards such more open attitudes. So, for example, in Canada, for example.
Well, we're reaching the end here. I would just ask about, we haven't even talked about the other smaller parties. I mean, we're not going to talk in detail about them, but I just have to mention that the NEOS here in Austria, like a liberal party, similar to the German FDP. And the Greens that didn't manage to reach 4%, and they're therefore out of the parliament for the next legislative period. And the List Pilz, which was one of the with a Green dissident. I think the question that most people are asking themselves is, what happened to the Greens? They just they were so successful last year. They elected the president of Austria, which is considerable, and then not even reaching 4%. What have they done wrong in so little time?
Well, I think many people just voted for the Social Democrats instead because they wanted to strengthen them. So they just weren't inspired by the Greens campaign. They just in an election campaign where immigration was the key topic, and they take positions that are sort of not that popular, and they just didn't manage to appeal to the public.
Such as, or what positions would you do?
Well, I mean, basically, the Greens in the popular imagination, they stand for positions that are just very welcoming. They're the sort of welcome culture, and they think more immigration is good, and very simplistic, and they sort of don't talk about or acknowledge possible challenges which come about with increasing integration, which, whether they exist or not, people think there are these challenges, and they just don't address them. So these people see them as naive. But that was one problem. But the other problem was that they just didn't sort of have any topics that really broke through in the campaign, and so they were kind of voiceless and ignored. And the candidates they had weren't particularly prominent, and so they just got lost, and they just don't represent the current climate very well. It's not a climate where their kind of approach is that popular.
There's been a lot of infighting between the parties, and well, that's one of the reasons why this prominent green politician Peter Pilz left the party in the first place and formed his own. Well, it's not a party; it's kind of a list. Mm. You would say that, and that's been some analysts have said that's one of the reasons why they failed. But I wonder, does that even make a difference for the electorate? I mean, if the party I actually vote for, if there's infighting going on, why should I care? I mean, I've always wondered, does that even make a difference for the average voter?
Yeah, I mean, people don't mind a bit of sort of ambiguity in a party, like if it's not really clear about the stance, but if there's infighting, that's really unpopular. So there's a lot of scientific studies to show that like parties that are seen as divided, that are seen as unclear about who's the real leader and so on, that is always negative. It just doesn't come across very well. Because also, for the voter, you don't really know what you're electing. You're electing someone who can't really agree in a position, or where different people hate each other and can't work together. I mean, that's not the kind of people you want to represent you. Yeah. So it makes sense for that kind of thing to elicit a negative reaction.
Okay. Well, last but not least, how do you imagine the next 5 years in Austria politically? Anyways, I know you don't have your crystal ball with you.
I left my crystal ball at home. But I think you're probably right. There will be a right-wing coalition, and they will probably manage to reform some aspects of the immigration system and also make the economy more liberal, because that's pretty much their stance. I do think that if the Social Democrats will get stronger in opposition, because if the right-wing government makes strong new policies, then that will create a counter-reaction. So I think, you know, in 4 or 5 years, you might see a strengthened Social Democratic Party actually out of this. So maybe the Greens as well. So it's always hard to events always happen, so it's hard to predict, but I don't think that I think there'll be a lot of conflict within the right wing parties, within the two right wing parties,
between the Freedom Party and
the Conservatives. Well, they will create. There's always conflict. They'll try to create conflict, and the Freedom Party is not always the most competent in governing. So I can imagine that will be exploited by the center left. So I don't see this sort of being as a 10-year period or 15-year period where the right is in power necessarily.
Because judging from the outside, they seem to get along so well.
They have very similar positions, but if you have similar positions, then you have to do even more to look unique.
To distance yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Voters. Yeah, just so you don't, do, you know, to seem like something that's worth voting for.
Okay. Well, we'll see about that. Well, maybe we'll come back in 5 years.
Yes.
And ask you again. Thank you very much, Mr. Wagner, for the interview.
Pleasure.